Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of the London Writers Salon podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Parul. And each week we sit down with a writer that we admire to talk about the craft of writing and the art of building a successful and sustainable writing career.
These interviews are recorded live with our global writing community. If you would like to join us for the next recording or write with us at our daily Writers Hour writing sessions, head to londonwriterssalon.com for more information.
In this episode, we interview the TV and film agent Nish Panchal from the Curtis Brown Agency. He's been building his list of writers, directors, and filmmakers for over a decade. And so we asked Nish how he worked his way up in the industry, from getting his first internship at the BBC to eventually becoming an agent at Curtis Brown. And we really started to dig into what his role involves and how he supports writers. For example, he went into the details of how he helped the writer Selena Lim land her position in the writers' rooms of incredible shows like Sex Education and Hannah.
Nish was so helpful and generous with us, giving us a high-level overview of the main players in the TV and film industry and sharing how a budding writer can make connections and break into it. Nish receives tons of emails every week from writers looking for agent representation, and he shares with us how he decides which of those emails to open and pursue. For anyone looking to break into the industry of TV and film and understand the mind of an agent, this one's for you. We hope you enjoy our interview with Nish Panchal. Welcome to the stage. Nish, come on down. Woo! The crowd goes,
thank you. Hello. That's how it would be if this wasn't lockdown times.
One of the questions we've been asking some of our recent guests is if we could be holding this interview in any venue in London or somewhere in the world, where would we be?
That's a curveball. That's a tough one. I've always wanted to play Wembley. Right. Should we say that? I won't fill it out, but maybe we'd say like the steps outside the stadium.
No, we'll fill it out, Nish. We'll have them queuing outside.
Yeah, gosh. Or failing that, just like some kind of tropical island, like on a beach somewhere around a fire, that would be nice.
Wonderful.
Yeah, well, we can imagine we're Wembley Stadium on a tropical island, so maybe yeah, the best of both worlds. Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, imagine we're on a desert island and you somehow magically could only take 3 films or TV shows with you, like Desert Island Discs. What can't you be without for a year?
Film or TV show? God. Yeah. Well, it's sad, but like I just do keep returning to Friends because it reminds me of good times. And like, especially this year, a lot of Friends has been watched. I mean, I'd say it's timeless. It's got a lot of heat recently, hasn't it, for being not very timeless. But for me, it's great. And then in terms of serious television, I think Mad Men is like the thing that I just constantly always return to, and I'm always dipping back into just episodes that I really loved because I'm sad like that, because I know it so well and I've watched the series like back to back twice now. I'll use references or certain episodes like that as examples of how to write television for clients. Sometimes I'm like, you know, you should look back at this episode because they really did this quite well in that. It's got its precinct and it's got its characters. It's got a really good ensemble of characters who are all going through different things. But there's not anything that you can't point to in Mad Men that could be of inspiration or could help you through a writing hold up.
Mm. It's interesting to see your taste. Everyone's tastes are different. Is there a third?
I just love the films of M. Night Shyamalan, and I know I'll probably get a lot of heat for that as well, but he's like a bit of a master of his craft. And to be honest, it was back when I was back in school, a teacher of ours taught our class how to analyze and deconstruct film, and she did it using Unbreakable, and that was the thing that made me want to get into doing what we do. I was like, I didn't know that you could watch a movie and then deconstruct it. It's like looking at art. And I didn't know that there was a career in kind of using that knowledge and skill set. Mm. And she made me realize I could do that for a course for university. So I was like, oh, I'll study film and that could be my way of getting a degree because there's nothing else that interests me. And then that is what led into this, what you guys very kindly called a career.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting to hear you phrase it that way. It's such an interesting path for you to have gone into being an agent for film and TV. It's, my father always calls this sort of career quite niche. I suppose it depends on perspective. I'm fascinated by that story of your teacher inspiring you to get in, analyzing masterworks. What sort of age was that? How were you thinking around careers?
I think everyone has that teacher. I hope everyone has that teacher, because I speak to other creatives and they're like, oh yeah, it was, you know, Mrs. that or Mr. that. And I'm like, yeah, Mrs. Richardson was my teacher. And it was sixth form, like lower sixth. And it was at the time where they're kind of encouraging you to think about what you should be looking at in terms of your university options. And I really didn't know what I wanted to study, except for that I liked watching films. And I kind of had a dream of being a screenwriter. And so I thought, that's a cool, and a friend of mine was going to University of Hertfordshire to study directing. So, and him and I would kind of be thinking about film ideas, and we'd go away and he was like, oh, have you seen Donnie Darko? And I was like, yeah, do you know Charlie Kaufman? And like, we really bonded over those kind of films around that time. And he went to study directing, and I was like, oh, I could write, like I should do that. Or I should, like, at least I have an interest in this. Like I should pursue that in some way. But because you're coming from like an Asian background, we had like no family friends, no parents, no nepotism going on here. If I was like, I want to go and do this for a career, I think my parents were like, just go and get a degree, like do that first. And so I did, I went and I wanted to study film, and Mrs. Richardson was like really, really encouraging. And she said, you know, go study film. You're good at it. You're really good at it. So go and do that. And then part of me was also had that nagging thing in the back of my head, which is like, film is not a legit subject matter. I've got to complement this with something. So I studied English literature as well to kind of appease the Indian family side of it. Not that it was like accounting or medicine, but it was at least like semi-legit. So I could be like, okay, I at least also have a film degree. And then also I started working when I was at the BBC, and they all had degrees like this. So my old boss studied Chinese history, and like they, none of them had real degrees. It was quite funny, but it taught me a lot actually. And Miss Richardson taught me a lot, because she said, well, it doesn't matter what you study or what your degree is, it's as long as you do it really well.
I can relate to so much of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Coming from an Indian family, going into publishing, my dad still calls it my niche hobby, I think.
I'm coming up to 10 years at an agency, and I think that qualifies for a career.
Mm. Nish, you mentioned BBC. What were you doing at the BBC?
Yeah, learned how to make tea and coffee really well there. Funnily enough, actually, I went to London Met, studied film and English, and then obviously didn't know what to do. And I spent about 6 months at home not knowing what I was going to be doing with this degree that I worked really hard for. And a friend of mine who was studying at London Film School, studying directing, he said, why don't you come? I need someone to like help paint the set for us. So I went and painted the set, and just by meeting various people on set, someone else was like, oh, I'm directing my film and you seem quite good, do you want to act in it? And then someone else was like, oh, do you want to like co-produce this short? And I ended up like being credited in like half of the London Film School shorts that year, because I just hung around and like I just had a key to the building at the end of it. Then at the same time, I also applied for an internship at the BBC. It was going to be on the month that I was supposed to be co-producing this film as well. So I called them up on the Friday and said, thank you. I'm like so looking forward to like coming in to do this, but I have this obligation on this film. Can we do it in January instead? And I never heard back from them for like 3 or 4 days. So I thought, oh no, I've like shot myself in the foot. I've not got the internship. And then I called them at the end of the week and I said, I just check in, is it okay to come back in January? And thankfully they said yes. So I started there as an intern, and at the time they were moving offices and they just kept me around. I was just moving boxes and trying to be helpful and making tea, doing all the kind of things that you do as an intern, but at the same time also just reading everything, because they were working with, you know, Simon Curtis and Simon Beaufoy, all of the Simons. They had like Julian Fellowes was writing a script for them. They had like all these really brilliant writers writing films for them. So I just used to take them home. And that's actually when I learned that I wasn't going to be a writer because I was reading all these amazing scripts by these writers. And I was like, I can no way compete with these people. But at the end of the internship, the move was still happening. So I think they said, I still think that they just needed me to move boxes, but they were like, no, you were really good. So we'll keep you around. And I ended up interning for about 4 or 5 months until I said, look, I'm basically a member of staff, so just give me a contract. And I just made myself invaluable. I saw two execs there who didn't have an assistant. And I thought, I just latched onto them and said, I will be your assistant. Just give me a job.
Sounds a lot like interning in a publishing house. That's really interesting to hear. Yeah. Tenacity and persistence there.
It was a different time. I think you just have to have a bit of that grit and like show that you are willing to do anything. And yeah, I had to like ask my mum to pay for my train fares because I was earning no money and all of this kind of stuff. But I just was really driven. I thought once I've got my foot in the door, I just make sure I stay there.
Wow, I love that. And so now you're with prestigious Curtis Brown. Let's connect those dots for us.
I was an assistant to these really brilliant execs, Joe and Jamie there. And the next step up, basically when you work at the BBC in the films department, you have a pot of money and you give it out. So you have a pot of fund and you give development money to producers who then give it to writers and they develop scripts. And when it gets to a certain point, you then invest in the film. So there's development money, there's production money, and there's license fees. It's a bit boring, but they pay the license fee, which gives them the right to air that film on the BBC. So they're kind of pre-buying the rights to the film. The team itself are quite small. You've got some executives, you've got a development team, and then you've got your lawyers, accountants, and assistants. And the next step up for me would have been working in development. So working as a script editor with these writers and making sure that the script itself, the document, is working and it's hitting the beats, the characters are there, we're getting into a position where a director wants to read it, getting into a position where actors are going to read and respond to it and attach themselves to it. So kind of doing that thing. And when I was there, it was the financial crash, that was 2008. And I felt like the BBC themselves were also, you could see every department was kind of getting smaller and smaller. And I saw that and I thought, I could either try and wait it out and get a development job here, which might take a few years, or I can just figure out what else there is to do in this world because I've got my foot in the door. What other jobs are there? You know, I looked at other script editing jobs and a friend of mine said, why don't you go and work at an agency? Because there's everything's there. Like you can go and work with a director if you want. You can go work with a writer, actors. Obviously, Curtis Brown has the book department too. And I initially applied to be Jenny Casarotto's assistant at Casarotto. For those of you that don't know, it's a huge agency. And Jenny is like, she is one of the most powerful agents in London, in the world, in fact. She represents like Steve McQueen and David Yates and like really amazing filmmakers. My friend also applied for the job and she got it and I didn't. And Jenny didn't interview me, but Jenny's like second in command interviewed me. And when she called to say you didn't get the job, she said, if you do this job, you won't enjoy agenting because it's very demanding. You'll be up till like 10, 11 at night. This is an admin job, really. So go and work somewhere else because we think you're good, but this isn't suited for you. So then, and she very kindly suggested me to Joe Phillips, who's an agent at Curtis Brown. And she said, this wasn't right for him, but we think you should meet him. So I then met Joe, and Joe was a younger agent. And the reason why it was a better fit was because he had mainly TV writing clients and directing clients. And I had the film experience of working at BBC Films. So instead of it being like an agent and assistant, which it was that kind of relationship, but he also bring me into meetings. He'd ask me for advice. Like it wasn't like that holy kind of admin role, which I kind of would have got bored of. And that, to be frank, I just wasn't very good at. So I started working for Joe, and it was 2 years there working as his assistant across his list of writers, directors, authors. That kind of gave me the experience that I needed. And at the time, the department itself was also, there were a few agents like me, all kind of in their mid to late 20s who were kind of itching to kind of get a promotion. And they just did this thing that no one's ever done before, is they saw four assistants and they said, we're all just going to promote you all at the same time. So they promoted us all at the same time.
That's great. So maybe now is the time where we get a little more into like what it means to be an agent, and also for writers in the room, the perspective, the hat that you're wearing, but also how you work with writers. So we've interviewed Selena Lim, who represent, also a bunch of other writers, Nikesh Shukla, Riz Ahmed.
Nikesh is a client of mine as well.
Yes, right. So we actually haven't interviewed them yet. We would love to, we're looking at your client list. So what is your role with these writers, and what are you doing on their behalf?
Oh, there's like mainly four things, I think, which I think come under my remit. I think it's about four, but it's like reading material and giving editorial advice is the main thing and probably the first thing we do. So, you know, a client like Selena, she should have scripts that she's written. She'll have ideas, and we read and we feedback with our knowledge of what the marketplace is like, what the broadcasters are looking for and what buyers are looking for and what production companies are looking for. So the editorial thing, reading feedback, contract negotiation, which is, you know, once we've sold an idea, making sure that the terms that she gets or he gets for selling a script or selling an idea, all the terms are good and up to standard and customary amongst like their peers in the industry. It sounds fun, but that's the most boring part of the job, and it's like the most time consuming.
Yeah.
Contract negotiation, getting work for clients. So as much as the traffic is going out that way, so ideas coming out into the world, they're also producers will come to us every day, and most of the jobs that my writers work on are jobs that come this way. So producer-led ideas, and they come to us and they say, we're looking for a writer for this book, or we've got this idea or this news article that we want a writer for. There's that, so the traffic coming this way. And if there's something that I think, you know, using Selena as an example, if there's something I think Selena would really respond to, then I'd say, well, you should read Selena, you should meet with her, you should talk to her. We think that she could be good for something like this. And then the fourth is just therapy. So like being there as a kind of therapist to the creative, because it's a really challenging environment. It's a really challenging industry to make headway. And I'm sure the people that you've had on the podcast have just been through hell and back, just trying to get a script made or even just get it written and completed. And there are times with writers, especially when they're working on their own, when they're in their home office and they're tapping away at the keyboard and they're like, I don't even know if this is good anymore. And so being that kind of ear, I think, and just kind of reassurance that the work they're doing is good, and also just being the one who's telling it, you know, like it is. If it's not good, we will also say that too. The therapy side of it is not that we call ourselves therapists, but that kind of side of it, of just having someone on the other side of the phone to talk to, is, I think, is really important. And I think is the most important thing, more so than any of the other things that I mentioned, is the most important thing to look out for when you've got a writer who's looking for an agent. Because if you don't have that relationship, then the rest of it won't really work. You then won't really trust your agent when they're giving you notes, kind of might not agree with all the kind of contractual points. I think it's that personality test is like the key thing that you want out of your relationship with an agent.
I like them a lot.
I know, Parul, you've kind of spoken to that as an editor sometimes when you're working with an author on their book. You're serving that role a little bit too, because the mindset is such a big part of the writing journey. And that's something that we talk about a lot in this community, is, you know, the work is one thing, but actually the persistence, the showing up, the camaraderie that comes with, and some people get it from you as an agent, which is great. It's so fascinating.
Yeah. You know, our knowledge as agents, like some people say gatekeepers, I think it's more like a facilitator, because every day we're talking to the broadcasters, the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Channel 5 now are really the main hubs in television right now. They're really the main buyers, and we're talking to them, we're talking to production companies that are working with them all the time. So we know and have a pretty good up-to-date knowledge of what they're asking for.
Right.
And oftentimes I think the main pitfalls that I see with writers who are getting into it, the industry, or is like, just look at what the TV schedules look like and see what people are putting on screen and paying money for. If your work falls in line with that, then great. But most of the time, all of our successful clients, their work doesn't fall into that that line. Their work is like out here, but it's our job to say, okay, this is your idea. How does that fit into this track? Because that's where really good television is made. Because if you look at Mad Men, for example, Mad Men is, you know, a precinct show, but you have all these bonkers ideas hit all over the place, but still they form into a kind of ensemble series that people watch and people can get like emotionally invested in.
There's a few things that I'd love to deconstruct. So first of all, I really do sense, and even from a conversation we had earlier, about how important your role is in being that person who knows all the right people across the industry. And I wonder if, for those of us who aren't as aware, could you talk us through the different component parts? So like in publishing, it feels a bit more straightforward. You have the writers, you have the agencies, you have the publishers. And then you have, of course, indie publishers as well. And within publishers, you have different departments. The TV industry to me seems less structured and more like the Wild West. And I wondered if you could just talk around the main players and who has the power within TV from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's shifting all the time. And actually, when I started at the agency, it really was the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Sky. More recently now, you've got Channel 5 making original content. The BBC and ITV have a new streaming platform called BritBox, who are making content. You've got Netflix and Amazon, who are investing heavily in the UK marketplace. Hulu are also dipping their foot into that marketplace. And then also just all the US streamers are also doing direct deals with writers and directors here and actors. We've struck a deal with HBO Max on a client who's writing a series for them. So the kind of whole world has just opened up, and really the streaming services have really helped expedite that process a lot, because it just means that there's so many different avenues. Speaking to what my role is in all of that, or any agent's role in that, is, you know, identifying A, the talent of a writer, and then B, kind of seeing where that writer's place is within that marketplace. And before, it's really difficult because you've got, you know, domestic terrestrial broadcasters. They'll do soaps, they'll do procedurals, they'll do their kind of more higher end kind of this lifestyle storytelling. Oh, and then there's sitcoms as well that sit alongside that as well. I don't have that many clients in comedy because it's just not my thing. But in the drama space, it's those areas. But now with the streamers, you can kind of write, you know, we've got clients writing on big epic sci-fi shows. We've got clients working on smaller kind of 3 or 4 parters. And then also on these big multi-series narratives like The Crown and things like that. So it's about identifying, you know, where does your writer client sit in that? And how are you going to help them develop their material in-house in this kind of incubation zone that we have before we send it out to the marketplace? And when we do send it out to the marketplace, who do we know? Because amongst those, the buyers that you've got at the top end, you have all these production companies that are dotted around. So you never sell directly to the BBC or to Amazon. Netflix is starting to do a bit of that, but ordinarily you sell it to a production company, which then sell it on to a buyer, broadcaster, SVOD channel. And so the key here is, how do we get it into the hands of a producer who's also then going to get into the hands of the right broadcaster or SVOD platform? So there's all these kind of different things going on at place. And then also you just need to know who the producers are. Like, you know, for example, Left Bank was the makers of The Crown, very successful TV producers. They're set up by Andy Harries and Suzanne Mackey, who ran the company. But Suzanne's just left because she's been given a lot of money from Netflix to start her own production company. Most writers aren't aware of these kind of shifts in the industry, whereas it's our business as agents to know that. So we'll make it our business to kind of make sure that we know, you know, who's owned by who, where the money's coming from, where our best opportunities to sell ideas to.
Someone like Selena, who's worked with you for a while and has been in the industry for a bit of time, does she ever need to know a lot of this detail, or is it something that you take care of?
She doesn't need to know it all, but it works well. And at the beginning, I'd say you don't really need to know. Just like, what are you passionate about writing? What story do you want to tell? What do you want to say about the world? What do you want to say about anything? And then let's discuss that between us and let's figure out how best to tell that story. So, for example, Channel 4 have a history of doing these really short, like 3 or 4 part State of the Nation pieces like Curie or National Treasure. I had a client come to me early on in lockdown and said, you know, I've got this big State of the Nation piece and I want it to be like, you know, 10 episodes of this huge story and this, that, and the other. And I was thinking, do you know what? That's great, but there are very few buyers that are going to invest that much money on a piece that's a State of the Nation piece. You know, it's going to be solely a British thing. This subject matter didn't really have that much interest abroad. Then we said, you know, why don't you see about if you can condense this into 3 or 4 parts? And if you do that, we can sell that, you know, focus on a character. We can build it around 1 or 2 actors as well. And let's try and set it up with a production company who make these 3 or 4 parts, the State of the Nation pieces. So we did. We sold it to the producer of Bodyguard, and they're developing that idea now with her. And it's more about that. We don't expect the writers to have that knowledge. You know, if they do, it's great. If you have, I think I'd encourage all of my writers to have an understanding of and an interest in the industry, but not everyone does, and that's fine. I think it is really interesting to have that interest now when we're seeing, especially looking at Netflix. I think everyone wants to have a Netflix project. I don't think there are any clients of mine who would have said a year ago, oh, you know, I want this to be on Netflix. So that's all they'd say. And actually I'd say to them, if you look at the deals that Netflix are offering, they're not that great. You know, the bad thing about Netflix, I'm not putting them down. I think they're great. But the thing that everyone needs to know about Netflix, if you make a show for Netflix, you're going to make it for a price. There'll be no upside to it. So you're making it for the global audience, and it's going to go to a global audience, and there's no back end. There's no net profits on a show like that. Whereas if you make a show for the BBC and it becomes a big success and you sell it almost like you'd sell an indie movie. So you'd sell it to the US, North America, you'd sell it South America, Europe, you sell it into these places, and there's a huge upside in the net profits.
You don't get to sell the territories separately with Netflix.
You don't. And the problem with Netflix is that they give you a little bit of a bump because they acknowledge that they're buying out the worldwide rights to it, but it doesn't compensate for what you're potentially, the potential upside reward of that. Mm.
So we want to earmark the financials because we want to come back to it toward the end because it's super fascinating for a lot of people. But curious, going back to the writer's perspective, how have some writers come to be represented by you or by Curtis Brown? Is there any one path in, or do you find them? Do they find you?
It's funnily enough, I was thinking about that because I knew that this would be a question that'd come up. And there were 4 writers that I signed out of lockdown, like during lockdown. I didn't imagine signing many people this year because obviously there's not that much going on, but all 4 came to me in different ways. The one way I usually now sign, because I haven't got as much bandwidth to take on new clients, but the way that the writer will get attention is via a recommendation. So if that's from a producer or another writer, it's usually that is the surefire way, just because if I know it's on whose opinion I trust and whose opinion I can get on board with, then I would usually read a spec. If you've been to one of the film schools, they usually do showcases, NFTS, London Film School. It's really expensive and it's really hard to get into, but the money that you spend in it, you get the care obviously during the course, and they teach you everything you need to know about the craft and the business. They have connections with all of the agencies as well, so they put on kind of days with the agencies and you get to have a round table with us, and we'll usually dip into the work. I think if there are, we had it just a few weeks ago, and there are a few writers on there who kind of stood out to me, and I thought, that's an interesting person. Just on a Zoom, like I was like, hey, that's an interesting person. I bet if I put them in a room with a producer, they'll really get on. And so you dip into the work and you're like, oh yeah, it's good, or it needs some work. So schools, introductions, we watch a lot of plays. So there might be some playwrights as well that we look at. Again, like that's a place for great incubation for writers who want to develop a voice. Writers who've had plays commissioned and put on and produced will understand the process of developing, rewriting, working with actors, working with commissioners as well. So all of that is a good way of getting the experience that you'll need in television too.
Hmm. Are any coming in cold?
One came in cold, and it came in cold to a colleague of mine. And what happens whenever someone just writes in code, if it's interesting enough, you know, if they outline what they've written. And in this email, the writer showed that they've reached out to loads of production companies and they'd had some conversations about their work. And they said, this producer read it and liked it. And so they suggested that I come to Curtis Brown. And so my colleague sent an email around to the whole of all of the agents in our department. And this is what we do, because oftentimes we can't always cover everything. So as a team, as a collective, we like to try and cover everything as a department. So this got sent around and one of my colleagues said, look, I don't have time for this right now, but does anyone want to take a look? And I wasn't really in the space to take anything on, but I read the blurb and it just said, yeah, I reached out to these people and my idea is this. And the idea was kind of hit a sweet spot for me, because it was about just subject matter I'm interested in. So I thought, okay, I'm going to take a read. I read it just that night because it was, you know, TV script. I just read it that evening. And the work really did speak to me. And I thought, wow, this is such a great piece of writing, so refreshing. Yeah, she's just about to get her second commission with a production company. We just was talking to her about an hour ago.
Great. I bet she's really excited to have written in cold and landed you as an agent. I'm curious to get into your mindset. So In your inbox, you get, like you say, colleagues have forwarded you these cold.
Yeah.
Maybe you get some. So one thing you pointed out is that if the idea is just really good, it catches your attention, that's great. Is there anything else that you might be looking out for? Maybe it's a particular type of experience or a portfolio?
No, I think... like generally a lot of people ask, like, what do I send through? I think just one good spec script is really all we need. And like a clear understanding of, like, from the writer of, like, what they want out of the relationship. So if it, you know, if you're an aspiring television writer, you know, having a strong spec pilot that can demonstrate that you can, you know, tell a story in 60 pages, set up a character and throw something interesting at them in 60 pages and set up a world, and then also at the end of it ask enough questions for us to make me think, oh, this is a great world, I'd love to know what happens next. You know, all those things are quite really hard to do technically, they're hard to do, and to do all of those structurally and also be fresh and original enough, it's really hard. Essentially, that is all I'm looking for in a TV spec, because if you can demonstrate those things, character writing, structure, ending on something good, a commercial hook, those are all the things that anyone that I send that script to are going to be looking for as well. And what we do with that is to send that out and try and sell it to a producer, but also send it to producers who are staffing up their writers' rooms. There's so many writers' rooms right now. And I think that if you can show that you can do those things in a spec script in an interesting enough way, most producers and script editors will want to have a conversation with you.
You touched a little bit on trends, and we're curious, what are some of the trends that you're seeing, either in the industry from your point of view, maybe it's the types of work that writers are submitting or what the production houses are looking for? What are you seeing?
What am I seeing? I mean, there's always procedurals are always like really important. I think for the domestic market, ITV are always looking for procedurals. And I mean, we've just got a client who's just been commissioned to write a new kind of Vera type series for ITV. And ITV appeal to the heartland British audience. So they will always want to have procedural shows, you know, what's a cop that's doing something interesting. There's something in the kind of comfort of killing someone in episode one and then resolving it by the end of the first episode, just in time for people's bedtime, so that they can feel like, oh, you know, I've been on a bit of a ride, but everything's okay and I can go to sleep safe and soundly. There's something in that, I think, which is still like a thing that people want to see. So a procedural, you know, like a detective solving a case, there's an engagement in that as well. Like if you're watching Luther or if you're watching Line of Duty, you're emotionally invested in that because you kind of want to be there feeling like you're there solving the case too, right? So a procedural, a precinct, I think Adam Kay, who wrote This Is Gonna Hurt, that was a huge deal for Netflix. And, you know, traditionally ER and what was the other one with the good looking guy? I can't remember, Grey's Anatomy. Like, hospitals are like, they're good spaces, aren't they, for drama. And they, not only do they have stakes and jeopardy, life and death stakes and jeopardy, but they also like tell like stories about like relationship stuff and, you know, I've got something going on at home. And like, it's almost like a microcosm for like your own workplace issues or your home issues or whatever. So procedurals, precinct shows, like those are always going to be like the heartland things. And then trends are like, look at books. Like I was just mentioned Adam Kay's This Is Gonna Hurt. Like that was a huge deal. And that's going to be adapted into a TV show. All these big books are eventually going to be sold to television producers because they just, that's where they find their stories. But those are big. I think true stories always have a place on film and TV. If you look at ITV's output over the last like few years, it's been consistently true crime stories. We just worked on Dez with them. We had a writer on that. And they're going to run out of serial killers soon. They're going to need some more, like, they're going to need some more more material. But yeah, true life stories, or what we're finding increasingly is like, how do we revisit history? How do we look through history in a modern lens? I've got a client working on a new show about Queen Elizabeth I and looking at it in a kind of modern lens of, wasn't it quite creepy that she became queen at like 13, 14, and she had all these men surrounding her who are in their like 20s and like potentially like suitors? And like, so it's kind of looking at it from a kind of modern day perspective, so that seeing, exposing it for its kind of creepiness, which at the time it wasn't really, you know, that was just the norm. But those kind of stories, I think, I would say are the trends.
Mm. I'm curious a little bit about what you also spoke. You spoke about books that are turning into TV deals. And I know you work with Conlon Walsh. I know you have Nikesh Shukla, for example, as a client. Are you always on the lookout for books? Do you just work with Conlon Walsh? Do you work with other book agents?
No, what we do is we have a really great guy who works in between our book department and our department, and he's got a hell of a job on his hands, because his task is to sell film and TV rights of the books. So usually you just kind of go to the cream off the top basically and say, these are the best sellers, so these are the ones that are going to go for loads of money. And he also does podcasts as well, which has been really good for him lately too. And I think podcasts are definitely, this year there's been a number of really big pickups in that space. How I engage with him is, if there's a client, usually director clients, but also sometimes writer clients who'll come and they'll be like, you know, I've just worked on this show for however long, or I need a bit of inspiration and I want to write something about X subject matter, or like I want to do like a crime story in Jersey or something like that. And Luke has a good database and he's like, oh, if you want something like that, you should probably read X, Y, and Z. And so we connect in with clients that way, which I think is good. And I think it's a way of engaging. But the truth is that if you then give a writer a book that came out, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, no one's really going to want to care about it that much. Like, the problem with our industry is it's all based on heat. And the new, bigger, better thing is always going to be the thing that sells. And if it's out for a year and no one's really looked at it, the likelihood is that it probably won't get looked at.
I see.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So we want to jump back to compensation, money. We're curious about what compensation looks like for writers and what they can expect to earn. And maybe there's not an expectation or a generality, but so we interviewed an author last week, Crystal Sutherland, who one of her books was optioned. Mm. And then she had a separate deal if it was greenlit. That sounded like it was percentage. And I was wondering if you can share, what can someone expect? Is it flat fee like Netflix or percentage? Are there royalties involved if someone does sell a piece of work?
Yeah, there's so many different ways in which it comes out. So if we stick to like a television idea, for example, typically, I don't want to like expose any of the writers, but like Selena, like it took time for someone like Selena because tons of talent. But the truth is that when you're working in this industry and you're generating ideas, sometimes it's going to take longer to get those ideas picked up. And typically when you sell an idea, you know, it's usually a couple of grand for a treatment. So the first stage is ordinarily is a treatment. and then you'll work on a treatment with a production company that pay you £2,000 to £5,000 for that, depending on the writer. And then they take that treatment and they take it to a buyer and they say, we've got this writer, this is the treatment, this is the story, this is the idea, will you commission a script?
Can you explain the concept of a treatment?
It's basically an outline of the series. So it's like, you'll have, this is the story, these are the characters, a statement from the writer, which I think is really the important thing to get right, is like, what is the intention that the writer is trying to manifest within this, in this show? What are they trying to say about the world? What do they want? What do they, what are the themes that they want to cover? And then the plot, and then a bit of the outline of episode one, maybe a bit of the, a little bit about what the rest of the series looks like. And it's really that, you know, it's like an intention document. And that can take anything up to like 12 to 18 months to kind of get right, you know, depending on how quick the production company work and how quick the writer work. You can expect to get a lot of those when you're starting out.
I'm curious whether you can give any sort of range of figure, even if it's...
Yeah, like I said, it's like either 2,000 to 5, 7, 10, depending on the idea, £1,000 for something like that. And then you'll get script fee. You know, if you go straight to script, if someone's saying, all right, we're going to put our hands in our pockets and we're going to pay you to write the script, that then is negotiable. I mean, typically right now, it's, as a new writer, you can expect anything from, I'd say, 15 to 20 thousand pounds, maybe a bit more if you've got a bit of experience or if you can show that you've got been paid more elsewhere. But typically it's that. That's paid kind of half on commencement, half on delivery, 25% on delivery and 25% when they finally accept the script. So where there's no more work to be done. So you get paid, say you're getting £20,000 to write a script, you'll get £10,000 when you sign the agreement and start. And then when you deliver the first draft, you'll get the £5,000. And then the murky bit is the next step, because there'll be so many revisions and so many tweaks and changes, and the producer will want to finesse it so much that it's in a perfect position to take out to a broadcaster or a buyer. That that's typically the bit that lasts the longest. So between delivery and acceptance being final acceptance, is where a lot of turmoil in writers' heads occur.
Right. Yeah, it's because there's so many different people involved in,
yeah,
the final product. That's interesting. And say like a deal with Netflix, I'm curious, because you spoke about them not being a tough customer because they're not paying for individual territory rights. I'm curious, like, what does that process look like? Can you talk about the fees involved? Like, how does that
work? Netflix is just a bit different in that if you're writing for the BBC, you'll typically get, if we use that £20,000 example, you get paid £20,000 to write an episode of television. And then when that episode goes into production, you get 100% buyout of that fee. So if it's 20%, you get £20,000. You get £20,000 again on first day of principal photography. And that is them buying the rights to show your work on television and buying the rights in advance. It's called a subsequent use advance. They pay 100%, that buys the rights for one or two transmissions. And then any time your show is then repeated again, you get a small percentage of that fee. So you're always getting, based on the success of that show and that episode, you're always getting a residual. What Netflix do is they just say, well, we're just going to pay you 125% and there are no residuals. So it could be that you're writing The Crown or you're writing Ozark and, you know, that show is being seen by everyone around the world, maybe more than once as well, and you're only getting 125%. Whereas if you write a show like, I don't know, something like Death in Paradise gets repeated a lot, or Midsummer Murders gets repeated a lot all around the world, you can get residuals for a really long time with a show like that.
I wonder if that's why Friends pulled from Netflix in the US. Maybe something to do with not getting enough residuals.
Friends?
Yeah, Friends, the series, was pulled from Netflix, I think, in the US.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I think it's that's got something to do with their Warner Brothers ownership, and that Warner's just wanted to put all their shows on HBO Max.
I see.
What percentage of writers that you represent are able to make it, like, as a full-time TV film writer? So I know when we did talk to Celine and she was very open with us, she said, yeah, I also have a a day job. Of the writers that you represent, how many this is their primary income versus they have a day job?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I feel embarrassed. I don't even know that. I don't know how in-depth Selena went, but I think with Selena, we definitely said this year she's written on, I'd say, two of the biggest shows on the streaming platform. She's written on Sex Education for Netflix, which is a huge show for them, and she's written on Hannah for Amazon, which is their biggest show. And those were very healthy fees. The issue with kind of managing, as a writer, I'd say the issue of managing that with a day job is that those fees are kind of paid out across the year, but then you can have a kind of career like this, or your writing income could be like this, where sometimes it's you're getting paid a lot of money and things are going into production, or there are times where you're like, you know, there's not as much coming through. I think for a writer like Selena, I think if you're good, if you deliver on time, if you get on with the producers, and I said it again, but it's probably worth saying twice, if you're good, you're not going to suffer from any of those dry spells. With Selena, she's writing on other people's shows, so that's, you know, guaranteed production if you're writing on Sex Education or Hannah. So you just know going into that process, either you're going to get fired or you're going to see it through. And that's it's a big chunk of time, but there's money at the end of it, which is great. So what we try to do is balance that with some original production. So again, having a few of those outlines and treatment fees, and hopefully if you're in Selena's position now, you know, producers will have the confidence enough to say, well, we'll pay out of our own pocket a script fee for that, so that she can write that, because we know she's in demand. So it's a mixture of getting those things right. So having writing for other people's shows, and also having some of your own developments going on in the background. And then if you kind of phase out the writing for other people's shows and solely start working on your own and be compensated enough for that, which a couple of writers are now, when you've got a show in production, which is your own show, you can earn a living from that. For sure.
Thank you. Very helpful.
My question is actually going back to you, and I always like to think about the motivation of an agent, because I think it's always interesting as a writer to think about what motivates you. And I'm wondering, is it just simply having a Phoebe Waller-Bridge on your books? Is it getting that dream client? What would be your ideal situation in, say, 5 years?
I think it's just like helping. Like, yeah, having someone like a Phoebe Waller-Bridge would be great, obviously. I think it's the problem with our industry, or as an agent, is that you just never know what the future's going to hold for your clients. You never know if, A, you're going to even represent them anymore, you know? So it's not really about having that one client. I think just the more that you can help, having a Phoebe now is great, but having someone like Phoebe when they're starting out and you going on that journey with them is more the important thing. I think, funnily enough, because it's the end of the year, we were doing a lot of reflecting, and there was a couple of writers, two mainly writers who I represent, and we were like, you know, it's been a hell of a year, hasn't it? It's a lot of stuff has turned around, especially in a year where there's a global pandemic and stuff like that. And I think, just speaking to the last question, just when you can get someone out of their day job and have them fully earn a living from writing is, I think it's like the most kind of satisfaction comes from that.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you for your honesty, for your generosity, and the insight you've given us. I feel like we've had a chance to look behind the scenes of what happens in your career. Oh,
good. No, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for all the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning into the London Writers Salon podcast. If you enjoyed our chat and would like to join us for the next one, please visit londonwriterssalon.com for more information on how to become a member. As a member, you will also have access to our interview archive, workshops, and our cozy online writing community. Whatever kind of writer you are, it is an excellent place to make new creative connections and focus on your craft.
And if you struggle to find time to write, like so many writers we know, you're welcome to write with us at Writer's Hour. It's a free, virtual, hour-long writing session. It runs Monday to Friday, 4 times a day, and all you need is the desire to write, something to write with, and a drink of your choice to cheers us. We think it's the world's best virtual co-working space for writers, creatives, or really anyone who just needs to get work done. Visit writershour.com to sign up, and we hope to see you there until we write again. Cheers, everyone. Thank you.